Do we have a clock?
Hello.
Oh, you need a clock.
No. I'm Brian Munch. This is Anthony Rashetsky. And the man in red is David Young. We're all electrical engineers. We were all co-ops at AudioPack. You may remember this from last time. We're doing a blind test response unit for use in intelligibility testing, which is a test that we use a lot at AudioPack. And our technical advisor is Buckner, so Anthony's going to talk about the project description.
Like last time, our project is to simplify a test at AudioPack. We're using an electronic fixture to replace the manual scoring, manual paper sheets that need to be processed after each test. So that's the main goal. We want to simplify it down, condense it down to where we don't spend twice as long grading the test as we did taking the test. To start, we wanted to show that we are looking into our LCD display. And we started with some sample code. And we want to program the PIC with this code so it displays on the LCD screen words and whatnot, what the user to read as the test starts. This is some sample code. The code obviously outputs AudioPack, since that's the company we work for. That would be a good promotion. And then it'll go right into the test. The six buttons will correspond to the six choices, and you have a back button and two reset buttons for if the test is messed up or somebody is off track. So with that, we'll go into our hardware portion with Dave. All
right, so in addition to writing the code for using the LCD screen, we've got the circuit schematic all set up. It's really hard to see the pins, I'm sure, from where you're sitting. So I outlined the different components where we've got the LCD interface, the user interface buttons, the oscillator for the PIC chip, and the flash memory interface. Once we had all that together, we were able to calculate values for the resistors and capacitors. Some things to note on this would be the two buttons it would take to reset. We didn't want somebody to accidentally hit the reset button. We thought two would be good, so that we wouldn't have to reset the whole test for everybody. And the switches will be push button, so that it won't be sliding or a knob or anything to be counterintuitive. The push button will be right next to the words that people can select, and it should be really user-friendly.
So this is our updated Gantt chart, our project management plan. So far, we've stayed on task. We restructured a little bit after our first oral presentation with Dura, as I'm sure many people did. We have our main two, these are our two priorities. You can split the task or the project up into two main tasks, making sure that the user responses are stored into memory and that the words are displayed correctly on the LCD screen. So we're splitting up those two tasks. I'm going to be covering the memory is compact flash and the programming with that. And then Anthony and Dave are going to cover the LCD and the programming for that. So that way we're working in parallel. If we come across some risks or something, it won't be as much of an issue because we're not waiting on somebody. And then, yeah, the yellow bars where we are now. And the things we have left are basically just to set up the circuit, put a test circuit on a breadboard, and then actually lay out a board and build the parts for that. So that's it. This is the final slide, the quad chart.
Obviously, we have our title, which we just explained. Our what it is, it's the modified Rhine test. It's just a simplification of a test that we use at AudioPack for any hazardous communications. People use this test, and we want to make a test fixture so it's easier for the user to complete the test. Our accomplishments, we bought all of our parts, the LCD screen, the PIC chip, and everything, the switches. We're working on the program, and we've designed a test circuit that we think will work. And once we verify that it works, we're going to lay out a PCB and process it and design the actual box. And as you can see in our final quadrant, This is a stack of papers that was recently done for a test at AudioPack. You can see there's probably about 250 pages there, and I need to go through them one at a time to see what the grades are. And our box will take that 250 pages and make it computer available. It's electronic. You can access it to a computer and grade it there instead of wasting 8 hours to grade each page one at a time. Any questions?
Could you do that for Engineering 210? It'd be great if we could speed up grading there.
If you make the grades multiple choice, maybe.
Okay. Okay. Actually, students might prefer that. I have one question. Are you still planning on using a compact flash card or something to transfer the data?
Yeah.
And if so, have you given any thought to the socketing or how easy it's going to be to get in and out of the unit?
There's stock units that they have that they let you project it really easily. It's just a little inside. It'll fit right on the bottom of the box.
Oh, okay. It's going to be on the bottom. I didn't see any slot or anything for where you put in a compact.
It's flash over on this side, the non-visible side.
Okay. Okay. Bob, great improvement. 8 hours to 8 seconds.
Question. Why do you choose compact flash over setting just download information for serial port or some sort of wireless system or network coming together and have one computer be able to handle all the data?
I suppose you just think that thinking would work well. Compact flash, you can pop it out. We already have a bunch of readers at AudioPack. You won't have to crawl behind a desk and plug in USB.
And I don't think
that no one's really saying you should go with Bluetooth.
We want to keep it also fairly cheap for AudioPack. They don't want to buy another computer to just have it for intelligibility. They'd rather have us process the scores more quickly than with all the papers.
Nothing wrong with corporate constraints and options. Nothing wrong. Okay. So is AudioPack eagerly looking forward to using this next semester?
Brian Enderby did.
Okay.
We'll put it this way. The engineering support team is eagerly looking forward
to it. Which means all the co-ops.
All the co-ops.
Okay, good. Okay, very good. Let's see. Shock. Okay.
This is the folder?
Yeah, that's perfect. Okay. Now, for some reason, here's a pointer if you guys need one.
Right.
And actually, we'll start getting set up for our next one. We have our another volunteer. Sure. People just want it. What's happening on Wednesday that everyone wants to get it done today?
I'm going to leave today.
I guess you won't show up on Wednesday. Just kidding. By the way, I will make one comment. Unfortunately, it's not one of the projects that we're going to show, but we've gotten our first senior project movies. Okay? People have taken video of their projects working, and this is something to be thinking about for your final project presentation. If you've got anything physical, it's always almost like gambling to bring a demonstration in and hope that it will work during the senior project presentation. Whereas the video, so you can edit it and it always works. Remember, it only needs to work once. So you might want to start thinking about videos or still pictures or whatever is appropriate. And we do have both digital cameras and still cameras if you want to take pictures of your senior projects. All you have to do is see Paul Schneider and you will find them out. And anything usually with the FSAE is probably something that's good for a couple pictures. Okay.
All right.
I've got a bunch of them from Laparo that you can borrow. Okay, so fire away.
All right, hello. My name is Tyler Wilhite, and this is Samir Patel and James Myers, and we are with the Case Formula SAE Shock Position Sensor and Data Aggregator Project. And our advisors are Dr. Kenneth Laparo and Dan Howe. Since we haven't presented in front of the class before, we'll go over some of the basics of what our project is going to be. And the idea got started with the Formula SAE team. They just wanted to have a way to measure performance on their car, such as handling, which is the main thing that our shock position sensors are going to be measuring. And they wanted to do it in a way that they didn't have to put like one central data acquisition unit on it and then just have like a whole bunch of wiring. And by being able to place our design, our board, next to the shocks themselves, it reduces the wiring, and also we're going to be relaying data from other sensors, such as the tire temperature sensors and the brake position sensors, onto the central data acquisition unit. And yeah, just the basics of how we're measuring the shock position sensor. You have a linear potentiometer that's bolted onto the shock, so that as the shock moves, the linear potentiometer moves, changes resistance as seen by the wiper. If you apply voltage across it, it changes the voltage linearly. And we just need to do some basic analog gain and offset control and some noise filtering and buffering on the analog end. For power, we're using the 12-volt supply that's coming from the car battery, and we're turning that into 5 volts on board. And the heart of our board will be the PSoC, which can be programmed in C, which is going to be a little bit simpler for the project than using a PIC, which has to be programmed on like a lower level language. And the PSoC has both a microcontroller and an analog digital converter inherent in the chip. On the firmware side, we're going to be buffering the data before it goes on to the central data acquisition unit on some SRAM. And we'll be having serial communication to the existing data acquisition unit and also communication with the other sensors that we're relaying data for. And one new thing that was added from last time is that we're going to have an EEPROM on board to store our configuration files in an XML format. All right, here's onto our technical accomplishments. I've been mainly in charge of doing the analog circuit design. And some important points here are that since our goal for the semester is to create a working prototype, one important consideration was that once it's on the car, like the gain that we set for the prototype may not be the gain and the offset that they need for on the car, because the shocks just won't be going like the full range. And so to take care of this consideration, we are using pots for the gain and the offset control so that it can be adjusted while it's being tested on the car to find the optimal gain and offset to use the full range of the 12 bits on the A to B. And then once you know that, you can replace the pots with just regular resistors that have a better tolerance. We also have a regular two-pole RC noise filter just to reduce the noise. It's got a corner frequency around 16K. And then on the power side, we're using a plain old buck converter to step down from 12 volts to just above 5 volts, and then LDO is on there to take it down to 5 volts and reduce the ripple on the power supply. And Samir can tell you about the PCB layout, because he's been working a lot on that.
Yeah. All right, basically what we're doing with the PCB layout is we're working with PCB Express. Some people probably might know the program a little bit. It's been kind of a little bit of a challenge to work with this program. Over the last couple weeks, it's definitely been crazy, that's for sure. To do the design, we're using a two-layer board. Basically, we just have a top copper layer, and we're going to have some ground planes on the bottom layer. We're going to have separate ground planes. We'll have one for the power, one for analog, and we might have a small one if we have room to fit it in for the digital side, just so we can reduce on the couple of noise on our ground. We don't want a noisy ground, especially when we're putting this on a car and using the chassis as our main ground. Basically, our main requirements in doing this is to minimize the area. Right now, we're working with about a 3.5 by 5 inch board size. It's pretty small. It's tight. When we're using a 100 pin microcontroller and two SRAM chips, and we have a whole analog filter and a whole power conditioning circuit on the board, it's pretty difficult to fit it on there. But we're doing as best we can, and we're pretty close to ready to order, probably within the next few days. I wish I had a better picture. It's hard to get the picture up here because of the resolution concerns on with PCB Express, but it's very intricate in the digital section. Like I said, we're talking about almost 60 to 75 traces coming from the microcontroller to the SRAM, to the RS-232 port, so we can access the, actually do some debugging using the PC, and we also have three other SPI ports, three SPI ports downstream and one SPI port upstream. And the other complication that occurred with this was just the layout change as we went through it. We started off with a 48-pin microcontroller, and now we're up to a 100-pin microcontroller. We had no EEPROM configuration to set up our PSoC, and now we do. All these little changes kind of added to the length of time so we can do some of this PCB layout. But other than that, James will now talk about some of the firmware.
All right, it's been difficult to start on the firmware since, with a lot of the issues, we didn't have the hardware complete. But now we'll be able to head out on the firmware very smoothly. System-level flowchart for the firmware is completed, and we've started on the configuration of the programmable system on a chip, and we're looking to have that done by the end of the week, and we've also begun the functions and the function hierarchy for the firmware.
All right, and as you see at our management plan, we're significantly behind where we had anticipated being at this time, but this has been due to some hardware changes recommended by Advisor that we didn't have control for, that we didn't anticipate. So we've just been working hard this week on trying to get the PCB layout done, and it is pretty much ready to order right now, and also all our parts are ready to order. So we anticipate having our board in by the end of the week, and then from there we can make significant progress on the firmware and the debugging. And basically our workaround for this problem is that since we're significantly behind on the firmware, originally we just had it that James was going to be in charge of this, but now Smear and I had, at the beginning of the semester, looked at some of the modules for the firmware so that in anticipation of this, if we got behind, we could help out James with the firmware and try to speed that process up. And here you can see our lovely quad chart. We have the special Formula SAE logo up in the corner on our title page. And, it just title page, our names, sponsors. Then we hit some of the bullet points of, like, what our system is doing. It tells you what it's measuring. It tells you basically the importance of it, that we're localizing these measurements and reducing the wiring. And tells you the functions, the communication functions that this is taken care of, and the new point of that is storing the configuration on chip instead of having to store that at the central unit. And here it goes through our technical accomplishments, which we pretty much covered already. And here you can see, it's kind of small, but we thought that this was like our most major technical accomplishment so far is the PCB layout. So we wanted just to give you an idea of some of the intricacies that we're dealing with on this layout. And now if you have any questions.
How many layers? Just double layers?
Just a double layer, yeah.
Okay. Are you going, actually, out of curiosity, because, you know, you're dealing with very low-level analog signals for your data input, who's responsible for the overall grounding wiring connecting the different FSAE electronic units? Because, you know, you commented earlier putting it on an automotive chassis, relying on that ground, you know, likely to be noisy.
We have a ground connection going upstream to the data acquisition system. And then also, I mean, we have ground connections going downstream to the other other sensor units.
Okay. But some of you may need to take Garbert's instrumentation course. I know how it did. Okay. Yeah. Very good. Any other questions? Nothing? Okay. Very good. Okay. Who wants to, that's going next? Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, that's a very good one, too. Yeah. Any other volunteers, or do we start the description? Oh, another volunteer. Okay. So you'll go after these guys.
What are you doing?
Uh-oh. Problems.
The CD-ROM drive's possessed.
That may be.
This is it. Cancel. So I don't know where that came from.
It's everywhere.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we are also doing a Formula SAE project, basically, and this is going to be similar to the previous presentation, just a little different flavor. We're also working with Ken Laparo and Dan Howe. Oh, and my name is Nathan Smith, and this is Mr. Dan Zula. To describe our project, we need to know the importance of proper racing tuning. As you see here on in these two pictures, when the tuning is not, well, the suspension is not tuned properly, you can get one of two situations. You can see here in this thermal photograph, this dark band represents the tire. This part of the tire was not in as much contact with the road as these brighter parts. And over here, you have the opposite, where this part was in much more contact with the road. And that basically, you know, you lose traction that way, going around corners, and that's not good. So that's the problem that we're trying to solve for the Formula SAE team. Our solution is, so this in block diagram form, this, we have three pyrometers fed into this mysterious box called the tire temperature controller, which contains thermocouple compensation amplifiers for the low voltage signal coming in, and to make sure that the temperature readings are accurate, not just decide whatever they want to do depending on the ambient temperature and whatnot. And also a PIC microcontroller to control all the components and data flow. What have we done so far? Dan, take away this beautiful baby.
This is our PCB, and as Samir said, it is a bear to work with. Theirs is a lot harder, but by the same token, like, we started out thinking like we could have whatever PCB board we wanted. So we had like a 4x5 inch, and then Dan Howe was like, no, it's got to be 2.5x3.5. So that's 2.5 inches by 3.5 inches. And so everything shrunk. These guys are TSSOP, so thank God, like, Dan Howe figured out how to solder with the reflow oven, because otherwise we'd never be able to do that by hand. But to give you a basic walkthrough of our circuit, we have two Molex connectors, and those are just standard, like, pin connectors that will feed into our board. This is our power rail, and we did a similar thing to what the other group did, in which we have a DC-to-DC buck converter, so it switches to get from 12 volts to about 6.5 volts at this stage. But with switching supplies, you get lots of noise, so then good old-fashioned linear regulators over here take care of some of that ripple. So over here, nominally, this rail, you get like 5 volts feeding the rest of the board. Our analog input stage is up here, so you have 1, 2, 3 thermocouples. These little guys over here are op-amp buffers. Like, they have really, really low bias current on the order of picoamps, and they also compensate the temperature offsets that they may cause. So we constantly, they have like a slow response time, but that's okay when you're dealing with thermocouples. But they're active and they constantly, they're called auto-zeroing amplifiers. So I was kind of impressed by that. And these big guys over here are dip packages just because they need to have a thermal mass to give them an ambient reference for like the thermocouple cold temperature compensation. So, but these are the amplifiers that handle the incoming analog signal. And then those get fed into this 44-pin pick over here that Nathan will be in charge of programming. I'll help out as soon as I get all of this kind of out of the way. But for the pick, we also, like the other group had, they had the potentiometer so they can tweak their A to D sampling range so they get better resolution. We have a similar thing, but our potentiometers are SPI programmable, so the pick can go in and set whatever the range is after seeing, like, okay, my low is only going to go down this far, and my high is only going to go down this far, so the pick can narrow in that range by itself. And then we just have an E2COM provide sort of a data buffer in case, like, communication is interrupted or some sort of fault occurs when talking to the data aggregator group box. So that's basically a walkthrough of our board. Hopefully we'll get this in order within today. Just needs a highlighter run through and make sure that there's no traces.
And then on the other side, we have some written code, and this is just with the MP Lab development environment. Some highlights here, we have this is some data writing code. You can see that the build actually succeeded, which is very nice, and that register values actually changed, so that this isn't just thrown in code. So we have some code that will work actually in the simulator. Naturally, we don't have the hardware yet to test it, but in the simulator, we've got it working, and that's exciting, at least to me. You see, our management plan here, the red line is today, and we're fairly up to speed. The PCB layout was quite difficult, and I have to applaud Dan for his work on that, because heaven knows I have no idea. But with working with PCB Express. And I guess it's kind of hard to see here.
Yeah, the upcoming thing that we have now is to assemble, test, and debug PCB. We foresee that we might have to push that back just a little bit, and we'll probably have to have a weekend of just working really hard to do that, just because if we place our order in within the next, either today or tomorrow, for the PCB board, the turnaround
So we'll probably start a week late, but we have some built-in time. I don't know if it's shown on.
Yes, there is a week buffer, flex time for any schematic software and PCB redesign. So there is flex time down the line that we can. Hopefully, we won't have to use too much of that. Maybe 1 or 2 days of that flex time, but it shouldn't be anything serious.
Yeah. And now here's our quad chart again. Dan Howe been really really helpful to us in making sure we know what we're doing. Basically, and what we are doing is we need to digitally sample these tire temperatures, get it from analog, the analog pyrometer signal, get into a digital format that can be read on a computer eventually. We've gotten our PCB layout almost completed. We've got some code so far that we can do, and we've got basically this beautiful four-color PCB Express layout that deserves its own square.
Okay.
So, any questions?
By the way, you do know industrial designs for PCB boards often go to 16 layers or more. So, just to let you know,
we were
even though this seems like a lot, but remember, at least with digital, there's auto routing.
Yeah.
With analog, it's all done by hand. I have one question.
Yes.
you've got a bunch of unused space in your PCB board. What's going to go in there?
No.
Yeah, there ought to be room for something.
This is a two-part project, so we plan on enhancing this design for the second semester.
Ooh, excellent answer.
We left space there. Dan Howell wants a dedicated force crystal oscillator, eventually, just because it works better. So for now, to get first part of the project complete, we're going to go and use the oscillator built in to pick. But eventually, we want room for maybe another oscillator, maybe some more S-band.
Yeah. Okay. So yes, the most of the space is going to be for the SRAM. We need some more of that for a bigger, beefier buffer.
Mm-hmm. Now, one question I raised in reading your midterm report was the field of view of the pyrometer and whether the sampling rate, you know, you've got three of them end to end that'll take care of room to room sampling, but is your spatial and temporal sampling rate adequate then to give you a complete circumferential profile of the tire? Did you read those comments?
I never saw them.
Yeah, we never.
Oh, okay.
Did you send those out?
Yeah. Well, that was actually in the one I returned. Did you get that one? Yeah. Okay. Because, you know, this is actually just an interesting little thing because, you know, what field of view means is that your camera has this 3D cone. And, you know, you indicated that it needs three to go from room to room. And I was just curious, based upon time samples, because I think you were running at, 100 hertz, something like that. Does that give you enough samples to go around continuously around the circumference?
Well, as you can see,
it probably does.
Like, there doesn't seem to be much change along, like,
yeah, and that's what I was curious, if you were actually undersampling it through the, you know, given real wheel rotation and stuff, or what? Because that just sort of seemed a little unknown.
Yeah, no, especially given we've been staring at these pictures since, you know, the beginning, and it,
it didn't seem that there would be much of a sharp gradient. The temperatures.
Yeah, you were much more interested in this profile than
So the bottom line, which is I guess what I was really asking, is how critical is the 100 hertz sampling rate? And it sounds like not that critical.
No, the 100 hertz sampling rate was just meant to make sure that we're sampling at least like 10 times faster than what the chemical couples can react to.
Okay, now I have a really, really hard question for you, which is probably outside your domain expertise. But instead of using, how much are these optical pyrometers?
Cost?
Yeah, like 2,000.
No, like 300.
Oh, 300. Couldn't they be replaced by a simple infrared photodiode?
Perhaps.
That's a good answer. But that's all I was looking for.
Like, I think
that's a future project.
Right. One of our colleagues actually pointed me in the right direction of showing me like thermopiles that we could have used. But, like, for the sake of getting this done in one semester, these are in stainless steel housings, so
that's worth it.
They're immune to noise, inherently. The cabling is all shielded from the manufacturer, so there's noise immunity along the cabling. They're hermetically sealed, so, and they have the air purge, across the lens.
Okay. So like, that's not
right. So, I mean, as the tires are picking up dust and stuff, you're keeping your lens clear. So, I mean, it's a little pricey, but you get your lens right.
Well, pointing lens is nice. And by the way, photodiodes usually will have a peak that's in the near infrared, more like 1 to 2 microns than that. Whereas I suspect these are going to be mid-infrared band, you know, probably more like 10 microns.
Yeah.
Because there's a difference between, for example, night vision, thermal vision, FLIR, and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they can actually pick up quite a big range, but they're designed to have a linear output in a certain range.
Okay, but it might be worthwhile to compare them just simply with some infrared photodiodes in a future project. Okay, very good. Questions? Go ahead.
Do you have any concerns about the mounting about like vibrations making it bump up against the tire or anything like that?
It's like, but fortunately, like, think we're going to have, like, mechanical students. Like,
yeah, that's another project. The arm itself, I think it's going to be, it's like a project.
Our controller, yeah, will be suspended right above the tire. And, like, the way, like, you took a filter with Dan Howe, and the only reasonable way to do it so that the controller actually stays the same distance above the tire. If you mount the controller to the frame, and the tire moves with, the, like, the shock position, then, you know, you're going to get a different field of view. So you're not going to get consistent readings. So you actually have to mount the controller, like, with an S-arm that snakes back into, like, the hub with the wheel. That's a challenging project in itself. Making, it can't be too big. It has to be strong. Yeah.
Always good to have Mechies work for double A's.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Work
that.
You work with it.
Good.
Okay, you had a question?
I'm just curious why you chose PC.
Because.
Yeah.
Correctly, because the animals.
Yeah, I think so. Our advisor passed it along to us.
I never used it. You were using WorkDev for them.
Oh, oh, okay.
You think we should have a class lecture on how to use DCB in stress? generate Gerber files so you can use any service rather than being locked in a DCB Express.
Well, yes. I think you don't have to. I think the PCB Express files other manufacturers can read. And the thing about PCB Express is it links the schematic.
That's
kind of
good. That's not very good, though.
Other
stuff's
yeah.
Not good.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, would you start
with
that agreement?
Just one.
Yeah, that's
the best part. It's for workhands.
Yeah, workhands are a standard industrial. There's a lot of unit packer products. But you start getting upwards in the $100,000 seat range for the really good ones. But there's a lot of good stuff out there. But they will lay out digital very, very well. Analog is a real art.
I thought, though, there was at least one or more questions.
Sure.
Are you guys thinking about marketing this for maybe the performance business sector?
I don't know. That's up to FSAE. I think they might want to have that competitive edge of how we have this wheel.
Yeah, but there's a lot of BMW owners out there.
That was last
step. I'm sure they would.
I don't know. I think it's ultimately up to FSAE since we're working to
into an interesting question. We're going to bring that up during Netflix discussions, which are next week. Okay. Good one, though. Always keep your eye open for a potential market for it. Excellent. Okay. We have another set of volunteers, right? We're going to talk about temperature control. So, you guys are next. Anyone else want to volunteer? Ooh, okay. Norman, the bots. We'll see who we get. Some of them are color coded. Oh, that's not listed. That explains all the numbers.
Yeah, I think that one will run out.
This is just like a game show. Is that a six or a nine? I guess I should have put a line on it. What do you think? Six or a nine? I'm not going to tell you what you want. Six? Six? Who's six? Spark my brain coming back in a rail. By the way, for most people who didn't know what Gerber is like the standard for photo files in the industry. Printed circuit board, yes, but also photomask for integrated circuits. It's used pretty much for everything. Any professional product uses it. Usually you pay for it. But everyone that's a real production house uses Gerber. Especially photomask. generation for integrated systems. So that's all Gerber. Everything we see here, I think, is Gerber. All of the equipment wants Gerber files as input. Go ahead.
Good. Hi, everybody. My name is Azad, and this is Imran. We are doing flow temperature control, and our advisor is Professor Kenneth Lepar. Okay, project description. For this project, we are dealing with a device called QTS-12, which is in Arduino 7-11. This device is purposely built for educational purpose, so that the student can learn more about heat exchange control system process. The main part of this device that we are going to use is the condenser, which is actually a big glass tube that has a glass coil inside it. The hot water will go through the inner coil, and at the same time, the cold water will go through the condenser and surrounds the inner coil. This will result to a heat exchange process. The heat will be transferred from the hot water to the cold water, and this will the consequence will be the temperature at cold water will be higher than the temperature at the core in that due to the heat exchange process. The goal of this project is to control the temperature of the cold water outlet using a LED view. And this project we have subdivided into three phases. And the first one is sensors and actuator calibration. Development of a metrical model. The third one is to design a closed-loop controller. We're going to use proportional integrated voltage control, or VID.
Until today, we have finished up the first phase of this project, which is the data calibration. So far, the data that we've got are all in voltages, and these voltages correspond to the hot water outlet temperature, cold water outlet temperature, cold water inlet temperature, and the NH flow rate. Then these voltages are being converted into the actual unit. This means that the voltages for the cold water outlet, hot water outlet, and cold water inlet are being converted into degrees Celsius, and its flow rate are being converted into liters second. And then the second phase of this project, which we are into right now, is developing a simulating model from a differential equation which describes the heat exchanger process. And so after finish up the building the simulating model, we should verify it by making sure that the output from the model, which is the cold water outlet temperature, should be the same as the reading recorded at the actual device, the QTS-12, provided that the same parameter are given to the system. This is our updated Gantt chart. Today we are on the 31st of October. And right now we can see that we have till the end of this week to finish up the simulating model and the verification. So we are on the right track, hopefully.
Okay, this is our core chart, basically just the same information as previous, except we have a additional image here, which is a screenshot from our data gathering lab view program. We designed this program to gather the data. This program is actually the first step to our final design, which is also a lab view user interface with an additional PID controller. What this data gathering program do is actually a change the valve position and record and get all the readings from the sensors and record it and automatically record it into a 4 spreadsheet files. We have 3 parts of the program. The right one is just a display from the sensors. This one is actually the part where the user can control the actuator, which is the valve. The valve will control the rate of water, flow rate of the water. The valve is the bulb can be manipulated in a range of 0 to 10 volt, and the step voltage is actually the increment voltage that this program will execute to change the bulb position, which changes the flow rate of the water. Okay, this part is just experimental setting, the number of samples, the total number of samples, time interval, and that's it. Any questions?
So you now have all of the calibration for the actuator and the sensors. You got constants for the information from the manufacturer.
No, actually.
Or you went and calibrated them yourself.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Never rely on the manufacturer. Okay. Is the only constant that you have to worry about in your mathematical model the B? Or are there other parameters that you're going to need to worry about to match, you know, the thermal flow across the walls of the heat exchanger and stuff? Because the mathematical model, you have a lot more stuff in your midterm report.
Okay. The mathematical model is actually a model for heat exchange process, not the whole, mm-hmm. the whole process. And B is actually constant, and B is not just the constant, but it's that,
So you've got more than just one constant
Occurring
there. Okay, that's what I wanted to make sure.
Okay.
So there's a lot of stuff hidden in B.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Any questions?
Questions? Okay. Random numbers. And I'm not sure if we'll get a chance to do one more after that. Just a lot of chance. Okay, what? 12. Let's see. Who's that? No, they already went. That was Ryan Test. Actually, we need a box back. Just a different number.
Just make it go fast.
21. Uh-oh. Oh, yes. That's going to be the Band-Aid software. Okay. So, Band-Aid software after this one. Yep, that should be it. I'm not sure if we'll get to it today. Depends on how long Kelly and Charles go.
It could be a while. It could be a while.
Okay. Yeah.
The rest of the class will pay you off if you keep coming.
Yeah, well, they might.
Come on, guys, pay attention. That's one of the questions. Hi, everybody. Again, I'm Charles Larrabee. This is Kelly Haley, and we are working on the random number generator project. Our technical advisor is Dr. Frank Merritt, and here's our second progress report. The device that we're making basically has a spark gap, where the spark can go in one of two directions. And the idea is that the direction is going to be completely random, and we're trying to sense which way it goes. And our original plan was to use a photodiode or a set of photodiodes to watch the spark and see where which side of the gap produced the most light and sample that signal. But now we're experimenting also with using a voltage divider, which would actually be a much simpler, more direct method. And the idea is that this signal is turned into a string of ones and zeros, which are then put into a computer via one of two methods. We're either going to use LabVIEW or LabVIEW, right?
Yeah.
LabVIEW or our first plan is actually to use the controller chip from a keyboard. So we'll just basically the device will just plug into the PS2 port, keyboard port on the back of a computer, and you open up a text editor and turn the thing on, and it'll just type 01001 01001 into the text editor. I think that would be the most fun way to do it, so that's what we're going to try to do. So that's the basic outline.
Okay. I'll hand it over to Chelsea. So what we've done so far is we've completed a lot of our preliminary research as far as looking at some other random number generator projects and also looking at some tests to verify the randomness of our string of numbers that we're going to eventually get out when we actually interface everything and get it into the computer. We've designed and built the SparkGap device, which we have a picture of later, and we've also designed and built the sensor and comparator circuit. We haven't, fully integrated everything together yet and tested it out, so there are a couple of things that we want to look at and try with that. We might need two comparators. We might only use one. Two would probably be better, because I think if we use the keyboard, we'll probably have to use one for the ones and one for the zeros and have them turn on like that. We've also talked about the sampling method, which is obviously the choice of using LabVIEW or using the keyboard. And we've had some issues getting the LabVIEW program because apparently Gmail spam filter blocks all of his attachments. So, but hopefully we can get that and take a look at that as well. Here's our updated project management plan. We're pretty much right on target. We haven't gotten quite as far with the sampling method as we wanted to by this point, but the red line shows you where we are today. And I haven't started researching the patents yet for the patent disclosure, but going to start that today. Yes, going to start that today. So other than that, we're pretty much still right on target. We haven't changed a whole lot of things from last time. We've just kind of adjusted and moved some things around. But that's about it. And this is our little summary. So, again, you can see who we are and what we're doing. Little summary of what our device does. And the biggest thing here are these little pictures. I don't know how clear these are to you guys back there, but this is our Tesla coil. And
you might mention what it came out of.
It came out of a stun gun.
Yeah. So
these are the little pieces that go on the bad guys.
Yeah. So, what we do is we hook up the ground electrode to one side and then the positive electrode to the other side, and that's about 24,000 volt potential. Of course, by the time it gets to our voltage divider, it's tiny, 10 to the minus 12 volts or something like that, so it's really small.
Better not be quite that small.
Well, it's pretty, we haven't measured it yet, but calculated it seems like it might be that small. This is sort of a close-up of what this little PCB layout looks like. There's a transformer and a giant capacitor. And this is actually where the initial spark gap is. This is just two pieces of metal crossed over each other. So it's very, very small. And then this is our electrode setup. And this is our positive, and these are our two ground electrodes. And then there's a wire coming off of here that connects to here. And then the two wires coming off of here connect to our voltage divider and then the ground.
These are just little pillars sandwiched in between two plexiglass plates.
Yeah, they're just like stacking screws for PCB. And then they're painted with this really cool green liquid electrical tape that Charles found, so that it doesn't arc between the screw heads, because it did before we did that. And this is our schematic, which this showed up really cruddy on here, but this is our high voltage here. And here's our positive electrode and our two negative electrodes. It's a voltage divider here, and I drew a little arc on one of them. And then right now this is shown with just one comparator, but most likely we'll end up using two instead, and just reference each one to ground instead of referencing them against each other. But then, I've got a pull-up resistor, and here would be our output to go into our sampling, whenever that is, interface with the computer. That's pretty much it.
Okay. By the way, a really, really good electrical insulation is bathtub coming.
Okay.
That's usually good for about 30,000 to
40,000
volts.
Wow.
Yes.
Courtesy of GE. Silicon-based.
Works really well.
Okay.
Also, you can buy Corona Dough, which used to be around.
Sounds expensive.
Old televisions. Actually, Sam probably has bottles of it.
Okay.
It's a red, reddish paint, and you just paint it on, and it's good for 50,000 plus volts.
Okay.
So, okay. Any questions?
Into the air, basically.
Okay. Yeah.
Through the air.
That's what creates the spark, the arc.
Although it's a statement of the secret project.
It is a lot. Well, yeah, it could. It is kind of a lot, but it's worth it.
It would be the kind of thing where you could probably scale it down a lot, but it just... Yeah, but why? I mean, this is really loud, actually.
Yeah.
Between the plates,
really
it's like...
Cool.
It's awesome.
Yeah, but I mean, the plexiglass plates are, like, this big, so... And then the electrodes are, like, right here. So it's not going to, like, fly out or anything like that. And,
yeah, and you've got electrical breakdown of air, you know, from Helix 1. That's what, about 24,000 volts per inch?
Yes.
Sure. By a show of hands, how many people aced fields? Okay. I'm just checking. I want to make sure I wasn't the only one.
Oh, that's fun, of course.
We hand measured them and drilled them.
Yeah, basically we measured them as close as we could to drill the holes, and then we kind of test it with the like run a spark over it and then see mm-hmm. how much it splits. And usually it starts going off all to one side, and then the pillars are like hexagonal, so you can kind of turn them a little bit, and the edges will, you know, kind of bias it one way or the other, and you can just kind of tweak it until the sparks go evenly.
Yeah, you did mention, you know, all the software is actually going to analyze it after you get it into the computer.
That's
make
true.
Sure that it's.
Yeah.
Totally
yeah.
Do you have any concerns about plugging snug gun into a computer?
Well, I mean, by the time it... What? I mean, we're interfacing with the voltage divider, and the voltage down there is going to be really small. So,
well,
and
the other
small
consideration
part.
Which they didn't mention was an optical isolator.
Well, even then, the main problem you have with spark gaps is that you have, like, capacitive discharge, and the high frequencies generated, the RF in particular, like you can get up into the gigahertz. An opto-isolator doesn't help you there because the capacitor couples across the opto-isolator. And sometimes if you get, like, you know, high enough energy gigahertz noise injected into physical logic systems, they get very unhappy.
Yeah, but a nice metal case might take care of it.
Or, you know, the RFI filters, the ferrite beads could be a
yes.
good thing.
Well, yeah, I think we're going to house it in like, an old ATX case, like a ATX power supply case. And then there's a ferrite bead on the keyboard lead.
To really make a sealed Faraday cage to get rid of the high frequency.
Oh, that's excellent. That's
fine. To make a sealed Faraday cage to block out gigahertz stuff is pretty tough, because if you have a small aperture, it'll shoot through.
That's great.
Bypass everything that comes into and out of the Faraday cage.
Yeah, it turns out that the aperture is, if you use the reciprocity theorem, it's the inverse of an antenna. So what you do is you get currents flowing about the periphery of the opening, and they act like an antenna. Just like having a dipole antenna, so you cannot have any holes at all in the case.
That's wild.
We can talk more about that offline. But then those are also heavy fields topics.
One more. We're using this program. I think it's called ENT or something. It's a thing that this guy wrote that uses like a chi-squared distribution to which a bunch of people have like written papers on this. It's like the best way to determine whether a sequence of numbers is random or not. I mean, basically, we're just going to sample 1,000 or 10,000 bits or whatever, and then just run them through this program, and it's going to tell us some statistics about that string that we're going to analyze and say, okay, yeah, this is a good random sequence, or this is a poor random sequence.
Yeah, apparently, chi-squared is what's used for everything.
how fast does it take walking?
You know, I'm not really sure. The last time I said it was probably like around 100 hertz. I'm thinking maybe more like 30 hertz, 30 to 60 maybe.
So you're not barking really, really
fast. Yeah.
No, that might overheat your.
Yeah.
Your taser.
Once you get to like about 400 hertz, it'll keep an eye on this path and just go to one terminal.
Yeah, you don't want to do it too fast. Okay. And I don't think anyone can do. Anyone want to try a 4-minute presentation? No. Tell you what we'll do next time is we'll try and go a little faster. So I'll probably ask most people next time to concentrate on their accomplishments, their management plan, and just do a cursory overview of the quad chart. So we'll really try to get more people in, with the exception of the people that have not presented in public before.